For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
The Olivet Discourse. It's on the Mount of Olives is where he gave it. And we have it recorded here in Luke, but also in Matthew 24, also in Mark 13. And so there's three different, all three of these, you know, recount this. But in typical historical writing, one will include details that the other didn't. The other will include details that the first one didn't. So it's best to kind of compare these to get everything, scoop up everything that's there. Particularly interested in Matthew tonight because he makes a couple of statements in Matthew that Luke didn't include and turned out to be pretty significant. Okay, if you were here last week, we read this verse where Jesus was up on the Mount of Olives and the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things happen?" Now, when they said these things, they were talking about him describing how not one stone of the temple would be left on top of another. And so this part, these things, refers to the destruction of Jerusalem in later in that same century, in the first century, around 70 AD. And they asked him another question, "What will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age?" That is talking about the last part of history as we know it, when immediately before God comes back and takes over the world. Jesus uses this term, the great tribulation. He says, "For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall again." So this is in a class by itself. "Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short." Great tribulation, that's what we're going to talk about tonight, because in the kind of sequence of prophetic events given in Scripture, that's the next thing on the list. Here's Jesus speaking in 33. The near-term fulfillment of the destruction of Jerusalem happened less than 40 years later. Then last week we saw that he said the Jews would be dispersed across the world and then they would be regathered to their nation. And the time in between these, the destruction and the return, is called the times of the Gentiles, the times of the non-Jewish people. And so there's going to be a shift where God starts working especially strongly among Jewish people near the end of history. So that was all covered. Basically, we covered all of that last week. Then sometime after the return of the Jews comes this great tribulation. And that is immediately followed by the second coming of Christ. He comes back. Okay, let's go to Luke. So he's covered everything up to this tribulation. He says there will be signs in the sun, the moon, and the stars on earth. Nations will be in anguish and perplexity at the roaring and tossing of the sea. Men will faint from terror, apprehension of what is coming on the world, for the heavens will be shaken. He says, at that time, they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. So right as this tribulation thing is happening, all of a sudden, Jesus just gets out the whistle and that's it. That's enough of your crap now. And humanity is on the verge of self-annihilation at that point. Like Jesus said, if he didn't put a stop to it, no one would have survived. It's war. It's our favorite pastime. And this is not like a normal war. This is going to be the war to end all wars and all of humanity unless God intervened and just said, okay, that's the end of that phase of history where you guys live according to what you think is right. Now I'm taking over, which should have been the case all along. "When these things begin to take place, stand up and lift up your heads because your redemption is drawing near." Rescue. Yeah. And he gave them this illustration. So he said, look at the fig tree or any other tree. He says, when your leaves come out, you know without being told that summer is near. And in the same way, when you see all these things taking place, you can know that the kingdom of God is near. And so these are what he calls the signs of the times. He says you can read the signs of seasons. You should be able to read the signs of the times. And he lists off a number of them in Matthew and in Luke. The Great Tribulation, quite a bit written about this period. Some of it is pretty mysterious, hard to really envision very real clearly. But the broad sweep of it, we can see, and we can see that it could never happen in the first place unless certain preconditions were met. In other words, there has to be a certain milieu and mixture of culture, technology, and so forth before the things we read about the tribulation would even be possible. And so it's interesting to look, and these are where you start to see the signs of the times. For instance, one of them that we went over last week, in all the accounts of the tribulation, Israel is a Jewish nation, again. And they're in control of the city of Jerusalem, and the temple has been rebuilt. So the temple part hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen. And definitely, Israel is back in their country. The building of the temple, who knows how long that could take. That could even happen within a couple of years, you know. So I'm not sure we'll see that very much before the tribulation, but it will happen either before or during the first part of the tribulation. That's a big one. Didn't see that one coming. Whoa. Yeah, far out. Then, too, we read that this tribulation period is a time of great human population. For example, in describing this last war of the world, the Armageddon campaign, in Revelation, he says the number of the armies of the horsemen was 200 million. He says, I heard that number. An incredible number. This isn't from one nation. This is probably from all sides put together. This is how many men are in the field. It's a staggering number. When you think of World War II, where all sides put together numbered about 50 million men in arms in that war. This is four times that size. And, you know, for every person that goes, for every soldier that's put on the field, there have to be a much sizable number of civilians that support that army, 15 or 20 usually. So this number implies that the population of Earth must be in the billions at this period. And, a lot of people aren't aware that human population has been relatively stable throughout most of history. Now, we could go back all the way back to whenever humans first came around. It would be way below. We didn't hit a billion people, until 1830, A.D., 1830. Then we hit another billion just 100 years later, a third billion by 1960, a fourth billion by 75, a fifth billion by 85, 6 billion by 96. Today, we're at 7.2 billion, and we're heading toward a number somewhere up around 10 billion max. Not in centuries, but in your lifetime. Not necessarily in mine. But you will live to see this not too long from now. And, think about that graph. Think about that line. How many of us here believe this is just going to keep going on indefinitely for thousands of years? That graph there is not going on for thousands of years like that. Something's going to have to happen. And, even if there were no Bible in existence and we just looked at that, we'd have to be like, holy crap, we got a problem here. A time of great population. Yep, got that. And it's going to get worse. We find a theme in the tribulation accounts is a globalization, a one world government, a one world mentality. And this is all predicted in connection with the villainous figure of the Antichrist, the beast, a great world ruler that captures the loyalty of the world. Now this gets a little complicated here, but just stick with me. Let's go back to Matthew, okay? We'll see how we get this. So when you see standing in the holy place, the abomination that causes desolation, in quotes, abomination of desolation, spoken of through Daniel the prophet, let the reader understand. Then, he says, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, for there will be a great tribulation, such as never happened, and so on. That verse we already read. So the coming of the tribulation, the great tribulation, is signaled by something called the abomination of desolation, which he says was taught in the prophet Daniel. That's an Old Testament prophet, a book of Daniel. This is actually in that 77's prophecy we studied a couple or 3 weeks ago. And we were reading this part, that after the 62 sevens, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. So the Messiah is cut off out of the land of living, killed, in other words. And this evil people of this evil one come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. It's the Romans. And so that happened after Jesus' death. And then he says, even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined. And so there's your fast forward button. And the next verse, what, this is as far as we read last time when we studied this. The next verse, we didn't read this part, but this is what Jesus is talking about. He says, and he, this prince who is to come, will make a firm covenant with the many, with the Jews, for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. Isn't that odd? He just said that the temple and the city would be destroyed. For Jews, you cannot offer sacrifice or grain offering anywhere other than the temple. In other words, it's back. It clearly has to be back, or else how would he put an end to it? And on the wing of abominations comes the one who makes desolate. That's it. It's the abomination of desolation, which is a technical Jewish term for defiling the temple of God. Paul explains this in 2 Thessalonians. He says the law, the son of perdition, the evil one, this Antichrist figure, is going to go into the temple of God and declare that he is God. Like Christ, like God being incarnated again. And so and people buy it. It's crazy. Anyway, here we are, okay. An abomination of desolation. Even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Now, so we see this link between the abomination of desolation and this great tribulation. And Jesus says, if you see that abomination of desolation, get out of the city, get to the mountains, and hope that you're not running in the winter. In the New Testament, this same figure comes up for coverage in the book of Revelation, where in chapter 13, it says the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. And it says it was also given to the beast to make war with the saints, with believers, and to overcome them. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. Tribe, people, tongue, and nation. That's four different ways of saying everybody minus nobody comes under the authority of this dude. It is a man, apparently. It is a man. Some people think, well, it's a computer system. The beast is a computer system. Doesn't look like it. No, it's a man personally. Now, there's probably a system involved as well. There probably is a system, but there's a man running it. In chapter 13:17, God says that the 10 nations in Europe are going to, God put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by giving their kingdoms over to the beast. People the world over are going to voluntarily join this coalition of nations or whatever it is. It's a world government. And so it's going to become finally the dream of having a one world government is going to come to pass. This guy's going to finally pull it off. What Napoleon wanted to do, what Hitler wanted to do, what Genghis Khan wanted to do, this guy finally does. Doesn't last too long, though. So we have one world. We're heading toward a one world government. And I think, I get this from, if you read in this field, a lot of thinkers believe that this is coming. Almost inevitably. One of the professors here at Ohio State has a book out about why a global government is inevitable. The pressures that are pushing us in this direction for the need is there. We can't afford to be fractionalized, warring separate powers that won't cooperate. Because the deepening crisis of the world is going to make the case for giving up some of our national, you know, prerogatives and freedom is just going to become overwhelming. Take, for example, the ecological pressure that is building and which is being ignored for the most part, and the bill is going to come due. Here, for instance, in the Living Planet Report, the most recent one, they have what they call the Global Planet, Living Planet Index, and they get this through 10,000 different points of data that they collect worldwide. They show that it has declined 52% relative to what it was in 1970. Diminishing natural resources, increasing pollution, and the loss of habitat, loss of soil, loss of fresh water that is threatening humanity. This is, I forget how to pronounce her name. She's a scholar. She's a professor at New York University. Each year, she says, world population grows by another 83 million, an increase greater than the population of Mexico. Good Lord. So a new Mexico every year is cast onto the world. That's a pretty big country. They got a lot of people down here, too. That's 83 million. But get this part. In those same 366 days, arable land, farmable land, diminished by 8,700 square miles, an area greater than twice the size of Jamaica. Topsoil being eroded away, and we're left with clay that won't grow cotton. It's no longer arable land. You wind up, forests are removed, delicate and thin soils are washed away, and you wind up with desertification, what they call it, which basically turns into a desert. The world's farmers are trying to feed almost 90 million more people per year with 24 billion fewer tons of topsoil, an amount equal to the soil on all of Australia's wheat land. That much is taken away each year. I had maps and everything on this. I'm keeping it short, though. Humanity currently needs the regenerative capacity. This is the Living Planet Report, again, which is a UN-funded ecological reporting agency. Humanity now needs the regenerative capacity of 1.5 Earths to provide the ecological goods and services we use each year. We've exceeded what the Earth can give us because of that earlier chart, the growth of the population. We're way over. Now, they point out this overshoot is possible because, for now, we can cut trees faster than they mature. We can harvest more fish than the oceans can replenish, or emit more carbon than the atmosphere and forests can absorb. But we're basically using up the ecological capital of the world, eating into that each year. The sum of all human demands no longer fits within what nature can renew. So that's a bill that's going to come due pretty soon. They were saying, as I was reading this, you can download this report, it's free on the internet. They were saying that most of the species of fish in the world will face a collapse in population by the year 2040, which means 90%, that they're less than 10% of their former historical population levels. So, you know, you overfish, you overpollute oceans, fresh water, ways, and so forth. Watched an amazing special recently about how the aquifers in India, in the Sahara, under the U.S., fossilized water thousands of feet down, immense amounts of water, fresh water, but they've been pumped out now for decades, and they level, for instance, in the U.S., a big aquifer in the middle of our country falls by a foot every year, and people have to, their wells go dry, they have to drill deeper and deeper, they're going to run out. And that, so much has been based on that. It's going to really rock the world food supply. The ecological pressure is going to get worse and worse. Then there's the global economy, which has burst upon the scene the past couple or three decades like nobody could believe. You know, in the late 40s, most countries had tariffs on an average of 95% of imported goods had to pay a tariff. So they were protecting their own workers against competition from abroad. Today, there's virtually no tariffs left anywhere, under 5%. So it's just completely reversed. And countries have thrown wide open the gate for trade. Everyone wants to get a piece of the action. And so these trade deals and so forth are about, all about taking off tariffs. And then it's just like doing business with someone in Indiana. There's really no difference. And so global markets have skyrocketed to an amazing degree. Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize winning economist. He's a professor at Columbia. He knows more about this than any of us here. His book, Making Globalization Work, he stresses the need for international frameworks and international courts as a necessary for the smooth functioning of the global economy, as federal courts and national laws are for national economies. He says we need something like that for the global economy, a government, governmental functions that function for the world, because we're not in a national economy. Globalization means that events in one part of the world have ripple effects elsewhere, as ideas and knowledge, goods and services, and capital and people move more easily across borders. And as the countries of the world become more closely integrated, they become more interdependent. Greater interdependence gives rise to a greater need for collective action to solve common problems. Think about how the U.S. banking crisis in 07 rocked the entire world, and we went into a deep recession, all because of misbehavior by bankers in the U.S. And so all these other countries are paying the price. And that has happened similarly with stock drops in Asia, in China, and some of the Asian tigers when they collapsed in a building bubble a number of years back. The whole world went into recession. So rich people, the people who are rich, that means the people who are powerful, know, they see, like what Stiglitz is saying here, we've got to get control of this situation. We can't do business. We can't continue to make the billions and let somebody screw around and ruin it for everyone. We've got to have controls. They've got to be international. Henry Wendt says the emergence of a full-blown global marketplace in which goods, money, and people flow easily back and forth across national borders around the world comes as a shock. Suddenly, the volume of world trade has reached staggering proportions. It's trillions and trillions of dollars circling the globe in investment and in import-export. And if this is our economy, it's a global economy, then how long is it going to take before people realize what Stiglitz was saying? We've got to protect that. We've got to get control of the bad players. The internet is another piece of this that is so totally functioning. You know, you can get online and order stuff from anywhere in the world, and that tendency is growing. Businesses tied together, the internet, you know, I'm old enough to remember when there was no such thing. It wasn't that long ago. I was middle-aged, and there still was no such thing. I think they just said that the internet a couple days ago had its 24th birthday. It was the 90s, yeah. That's when it came around. Today, you can make direct contact with people anywhere in the world. You can talk to each other and look at each other's face, Skype, back and forth. Because of the internet and the global economy, English is rapidly becoming the world trade language. People want to learn English. Everywhere you go in the world, people are eager to learn English because that's the language of the internet. Trade, communication, understanding peoples who did not formally understand each other because they never communicated. Now they do communicate freely, easily. It's a whole new world, and that distance, those language barriers, falling and becoming a global village, as some thinkers call it. And the corollary to that is a global government. It makes sense. Other things are pressing in this same direction as well. When we think of international terrorism and the way that could bring an economy to a screeching halt, think of what happened here on 9/11. And it absolutely threw the U.S. economy into a tailspin for quite a period of time. And, you know, it has that capacity wherever it goes. It can shut down entire cities. And you'll see stocks just falling in value and so forth from these attacks. This is a piece that really doesn't fit the end time scenario. So something's going to have to be done about it. And where it does fit is I can think that a common shared reaction to terrorism could cause countries that formerly didn't like each other to get over the differences and realize we've got to take a united stand. We've got to get this under control. The same thing with cybercrime. I was going to get into this, but I'm trying to keep it short. Cybercrime costs businesses in the U.S. $225 billion a year right now, growing rapidly. Think of all the hacks we've had this year. I had my freaking credit card changed on me 3 different times because I was in the Target hack, I was in the Home Depot hack, and somebody hacked my bank account. So every time, you know, I got to go through 20 different providers and give them my new number. Hate that. But the real ones that hate it are the rich, who are paying the bill. All of the theft and so forth that goes on under these hacks has to be reimbursed by the rich, by the banks, by the merchants. And it's costing them huge dollars. Something's got to be done. And so I would say when it comes to globalization as described in Scripture, it's not really here yet. Not yet. But we see the foundations of conditions that could easily lead people and are leading thinkers to that conclusion. All of these pressure points are clearly with us big time. And that is going to build, every one of these is building, is going to have more impact as time goes on. A fourth thing we can note about the Great Tribulation, it's a time of amazing technologies. For example, fiscal control systems. We read of this beast dude that he also forces everyone, the small, the great, the rich and the poor, the free and the slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, and so that nobody can buy or sell unless he has that mark. And the mark is a number. It says it's a number of the beast or of his name. Don't know what this is, but imagine that. Now, Rome was in power when this was written in the first century AD, about 90 AD. And they were pretty high control. But not that they could ever control what one person in some village sold to someone else or bought from someone else. Nobody's ever had that kind of control. How could anyone have this level of control that they can prevent anyone from participating in the economy? See, now in our day, that becomes a lot more plausible. And one of the big questions, which is what good would it do to put a number on? What good is that? We see today we can be like, yeah. What you need, the infrastructure for a worldwide electronic currency is really in place at this point. It's in place. And it's continuing to develop and refine. One of the worst parts about, though, having an electronic currency and all your transactions are electronic is that you get an order. How do you know that that's really that person on the other end? Security is a huge problem. Yeah, it's efficient, but it lacks security. Somehow the need is to be able to know this is him, and that's who's paying me. So maybe put a little something on there. Maybe it'll be like Pat's thing you sent out, to the tattoo, which stores, you know, a huge volume of data. Maybe it's an implanted chip or something like that. It's something they put on your hand, or I guess some people don't have a right hand, so they put it maybe on the forehead. Fiscal control systems. This is saying that a government is coming. It's a world government so powerful they can prevent anyone from buying or selling. They cannot participate in the economy. That's literally conceivable today. Never before, though. Never before. A very important point. Have you ever heard the cynical complaint that, oh, you know, crazy religious nutcases thought the end of the world was in 1000 AD, you know, and everybody was buying white clothes, get ready to go to Jesus. Nothing happened. Yeah, good point. A lot of phony, foolish claims. But I don't think, that whole idea, oh, this happens all the time. People think, I don't think this has happened before. Not that I know. I think we would know if there was ever the possibility of controlling who buys and sells by putting a number on people. I think we would have known that by now. It hasn't ever happened. Couldn't have ever happened. Today, it could. And so we're in a unique period, unlike any other period. We think of that graph of population. That's never happened before. That's all happened in our lifetimes. And this is not something that happens all the time at all. This one, global communications. How about the story in Revelation? They have these two guys that die, and it says they display their bodies. Their dead bodies lie in the street for 3.5 days. Men from every people, tribe, language, and nation. There's that expression again. For everyone on earth gazes on their bodies and refuses them burial. Now, it would take months just to journey from Israel to Spain by ship in ancient times when this was written. It would take months to get across the Roman Empire. This whole event's only 3.5 days long, and it says people from every nation gaze and can see with their own eyes. Oh, we know what that's talking about. We just did it. We just had the Olympics. In Rio, everyone in the world watched. No problem. And so we have implied television technology and satellite technology that would be necessary to view a live event like this. That's at hand. What about the devastating weapons that make up this awful war? What Jesus said, we read this where he said there will be a great tribulation, and if those days had not been cut short, no life would have survived. Now, you have to read, there's at least 20 to 30 passages about the tribulation scattered throughout Old and New Testament. And in the context, the reason that people are having trouble surviving is because it's a war. It's a world war. It's a war where people are burned to death. Something that was not very common in ancient warfare. You didn't burn to death. You got stabbed or hacked. Burning. No. It's not how you fought battles. A little different today, yeah. In fact, this is exactly what people worry about and should worry about, is we have thousands of nuclear weapons stockpiled, and more countries are going nuclear. The risk, people think, well, the threshold of risk for nuclear war is way down. Actually, experts in the field say it's way up. Because, yeah, Russia and the U.S. got rid of some of our warheads. You know, we went from 12,000 down to 3,000 each. That's nice. But at the same time, like half a dozen more nations, including rogue nations like North Korea, have nuclear weapons now. Others trying to get them still, like Iran. Those are the guys to worry about right there. They would launch. You think of the hatred between India and Pakistan. Pakistan. What can you say? Pakistan's got like 100 nuclear warheads and missile technology to deliver. That's a little bit more than China has. Think about that. China doesn't have a big stock of weapons. They're smart enough to realize 100 of them is all you need. Could totally annihilate any country with that. So, the technology needed in these accounts, it's here, it's at hand. All of these things are there. And so we begin to see, check down the line, not necessarily fully checked, but kind of heading in that direction. And we could add to this that in the scenario described for the Great Tribulation, it shows Europe reunited like it was in the time of Rome. It's like a reappearance of the Roman Empire. And that seems like a very implausible prediction when you study the history of Western Europe. All they've ever done is fight wars with each other, you know, forever. And this is saying, no, actually they're going to come together and this is going to be the most powerful nation on earth. This is going to be the nation that produces the beast, these guys. Interesting, the way things are headed in European history. This guy's book, The European Union, he's McCormick and Olson are authorities on the subject. They talk about the European Union today is the largest economic bloc in the world, accounting for 1/4 of global gross domestic product. Wow. So way more than the U.S. and about 20% of global trade. There's now virtually unlimited free movement of people, money, goods, and services among most of its states. Yeah, you can just drive across Europe now. They all spend to have the same currency. It's a global powerhouse, the world's largest economy, its second largest exporter and importer, and with a population of more than 500 million, significantly larger than the U.S. We've only got 350. 500 million in Europe. In the Maastricht Treaty that was concluded in 92, we read that the Union shall set itself the following objectives: to promote economic and social progress through the creation of an area without internal frontiers, through the establishment of an economic and monetary union, ultimately including a single currency. Well, that's already happened. The European, and this is their article. These are EU documents you can get on the EU website. This is called Agenda 2000, one of their articles there. The European Union has a global role to play. It must bolster its ability to take political decisions and to ensure that all of its various activities form a cohesive whole. The Europeans are set, the ones that believe in the Union, are set on the idea of becoming like a United States of Europe. That's what they want. And that's what these treaties say. Now, of course, you have all these nations who have a long history of competing with each other and hating each other and so forth. So progress has kind of gone forward and backward, but always ultimately forward. You know, forward three steps, backward two. You see Brexit. The British just dropped out of the EU. They'll probably go back in. They're already regretting it. It was a stupid move. But that won't affect anything. What we're seeing, the big picture of Europe trying to unite itself voluntarily, not through conquest, is the only time this has ever happened. This has never happened before, and yet the Bible predicts this is the way it's going to be at the end times. It's amazing. So again, a lot of these things on this list, absolutely unique, never seen anything like this before, and now we see it. And the Bible says that it's to be expected. So that kind of reminds you, and we'll just put a little question mark. I don't know whether this is it or not. I get the feeling it might be. I'm sure it's going to change from what we're seeing today, but it's just really weird to see those countries joining up with each other. Jesus says later in Luke 21, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Everything we look at is temporary. It's got a limit, a use-by date, except for the words of Christ. He says, you can count on these words. And remember what he said about the fig tree. Now you see the leaves coming out. Summer's at hand. This is going to be summer soon. And when we see the multiple signs that make up the scenario that fits the tribulation coming in all at the same time, all of these arrows are kind of converging at roughly the same period of history, our period. And it... I know what it says to me. I think summer is near. Summer is near.
Okay.
We could go into numerous other examples, but I just picked five of them. When Israel was exiled out of their country, the prophetic scenario, the sequence given prophetically kind of paused. And when they came back, apparently the stopwatch clicked and started to count again. That's what I think has happened. And I don't think it's coincidence that so many of these features that are described of the last days just happen to be showing up at the same time. I don't believe that at all. I think we're really seeing that those leaves are coming out on the fig tree. The message of the prophetic scenario is that, you know, humanity is proud. We feel like we can solve our problems. And just when humanity concludes that our modernity and our technology is going to save us and is going to fix our problems and so forth, actually, because of our corrupted nature, it's these very things that propel us to the verge of self-destruction. We can change, we can heal a disease. You know, we can clean up some garbage, but what can change the inside of humanity, the heart? James says in his book in the New Testament, where do wars come from? Is it not the lust inside of your own heart? Yeah, that's why people fight wars. We love to take, and we'll kill if we need to get it. And the real message of all of this is that we can be rescued. We're not going to be rescued by getting in the right government in place or by passing the right laws. Rescue is going to be individual and it's going to be spiritual. Jesus' big message at the end of the Olivet Discourse, in Matthew especially, is be ready for the coming of the Son of Man. It's going to happen and people are going to be like, they didn't expect it. And boom, it happens. To be ready for the coming of the Son of Man means that you have now accepted what he did for you when he came and went to the cross. So you've told God, I want to have you in my life and I would like the death of Christ to pay for my sins too. That's called receiving Christ. It's necessary to receive Christ, not just to go to church. That doesn't accomplish anything. What God wants is from my heart to him saying, I accept your leadership and your death on my behalf, and I'm accepting that. And it says in the Bible in John 1 that to as many as received him, he gave the right to become the children of God, to receive Christ. You could do that right here tonight. That's worth thinking about. Why not? It's free. It's a gift because God is a loving God. He wants to give you forgiveness. He wants to accept you forever. He wants to rescue you from this mess, which we didn't get to that part tonight, but there is a rescue plan in place. And this would be a great night to call out to God and say, I want to know you. It could really change your life. Well, let's draw the line there. Yes, God, it's so amazing to look at your prophetic word and realize that you've got it all covered, and that you are the God of history, and that your sovereignty spans from everlasting to everlasting. And it's so amazing that you care about us, especially enough to come and do what you did in Jesus. And we turn to him, Lord, those sitting here tonight thinking maybe I should call out to God, that they would just turn to you and say, God, I still have questions, but I do want to know you. I know I want to have you in my life. I want to have this free forgiveness, and I do accept that gift. Thank you for everyone here tonight that prayed that, God. Yeah. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.